From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll hear about the challenge of making San Francisco your new home when you don't have the right visa to stay.
It was a lot of frustration, and also I was lost because it meant I have to leave the country immediately. And I didn't know where to go.
Then we'll take a walk on the beach in the rain to clean up garbage.
I stepped in like this huge puddle. I was like, great.
Plus, we look at a Kickstarter campaign for your electricity bill.
Crowdsourcing and crowdfunding is a way that we can democratize energy, democratize finance.
Home sweet home, that's today on Cross Currents. The Board of Supervisors passed a bill yesterday that could affect undocumented immigrants living in San Francisco. Under the new Due Process for All ordinance, local law enforcement will not be required to hold undocumented immigrants for federal authorities if they are otherwise due to be released. Up until now, authorities have been required to hold detainees for at least 48 hours under a federal program called Secure Communities. Supervisor John Avalos is against the federal policy because of how it plays out among immigrants.
There's a fear of getting caught up and swept up into the criminal justice system. There's a fear of actually contacting the police when there's a crime happening. And people are afraid that it's going to lead to, you know, someone being deported, perhaps a family member, perhaps they themselves being caught up in the system.
Avalos has been on the front lines of immigration reform to rid the city of that law. Again, yesterday, the Board of Supervisors voted to pass an ordinance that makes it illegal for local police to detain anyone based on immigration status alone. For the past month, we've been bringing you stories of immigrants living in the Bay Area. Today, a young woman from France shares her story about trying to stay in the city with a specialized work visa.
My name is Cynthia Garcia, and I live in Switzerland now. I came in the Bay Area in October 2009. It was my first time in the U.S., and I was moving with my boyfriend at the time. I was with a tourist visa, and he was with a day one. And I stayed for the six-month period, which means that after 6 months, exactly 6 months, my visa was ending. I was about. I had to leave the country, and it was a perfect timing for me because I found an organization that was making for me an intern visa.
So you did that internship, and at the end of the internship, what happened?
So I had to go back to France, and at that time, with my organization, we talked about extending, having a new opportunity, job opportunity, but it was hard to make this organization move quickly, so I came back to France and then returned to the United States as a tourist again. And it was not the H-1B, which is the work visa, it was a H-3 visa. We talked about it with my boss at the time. We hired a lawyer. We were very willing to work together. I really enjoyed working with them as an intern, so this was a great experience for me, extending it and having a trainee visa, the H-3.
You were saying that the lawyer said, oh, there was no problem at all, you can have it.
Yes.
And boom.
Boom. First round, we provided the what the USCIS asked for, some proof that this training was not available in my country. So, which was hard actually, because it's easy to prove what does exist, but on the contrary, what doesn't exist is hard to find. So it was hard work for my colleagues because we have to come up with ideas. We felt like we reached that that goal. It was really detailed, but they wanted more. So it took us another 3 months. And so we started, like I said, the process in April, and we finally were able to end this after the second round in, I guess, in September. And then they proceeded to a decision. It took 3 or 4 weeks, and they denied again. So at that time, I received an official paper that said, you have to leave the country. I was destroyed. I don't know which word I should use, but I just cried. I couldn't believe that. I was traveling at that time, and I thought, this is impossible. Why? I put so much effort. My organization put so much effort making. At the end, it was probably 100 pages. 100 pages of research and proof that they were willing, I was willing, my lawyer was willing. So it was a lot of frustration, and also I was lost, because it meant I have to leave the country immediately. I didn't know where to go back to France, find a job. I didn't have any money because I wasn't allowed to work. So it was a really bad situation. Yeah, I felt it was unfair. I was wondering, the agent who was working behind, who had my file and decided to stamp the denial, what did he do? What was his research? Like, if you write on Google the name of my nonprofit, you certainly can find so many information and good reputation and one of its kind, like I said, organization where I could have learned so much. So I wonder, why did he decide not to give it to me?
That's Cynthia Garcia, a French woman who lived in the U.S. on a tourist visa last year. She currently lives in Switzerland. Her story was produced by KALW's Eva Sansan. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Today we're talking about what makes San Francisco the place many of us call home. And speaking of homes, there are still a few places in the city where people say it's affordable to buy one, like the Ingleside neighborhood. It's predominantly middle class, and more than half of residents own their own homes. It includes City College, and ethnically it's pretty diverse. We sent reporter Raisu Sussman to talk with some residents about what makes their neighborhood unique.
Oh, I've lived here for 50 years.
Hello. Hello. What's your name?
Leroy Riley.
When you think of the neighborhood, how would you describe it?
Well, I love the neighborhood. It's a friendly neighborhood, yeah. Neighbors are all friendly, yeah.
So, what's your name?
Lara Ortiz de Montellano.
How long have you lived here?
We moved here in 2008. There's a mix of the old black community and a lot of sort of immigrants who have kind of got their foothold in and are kind of moving on. Even the McDonald's turns out to be a real social center, which you wouldn't expect it's a McDonald's. But it turns out that student populations and the older residents and the younger residents, we all mix. There's one of the old dudes there and people bring him coffee, and it's a nice thing.
What was it like before?
Well, before, I mean, there wasn't much at all. I mean, it was kind of on the downward, going downhill instead of going uphill like it is now.
That audio postcard from the Ingleside neighborhood in San Francisco was produced by Raisu Sussman. And now we'll head west to San Francisco's Ocean Beach, where hundreds of people gathered over the weekend to tidy things up. The annual California Coastal Cleanup is the state's largest annual volunteer event, drawing tens of thousands of participants. This year it was scheduled for Saturday from 9 to noon, almost exactly coinciding with a surprising downpour that drenched the Bay Area. Part of the cleanup took place where Golden Gate Park meets the Pacific Ocean, close to where our executive news editor Ben Trefney lives. So he grabbed a recorder and his umbrella and headed out to the beach.
All right, I am walking in along the sand up over the sand dune at Judah Street, inside the Great Highway. If I didn't have this umbrella with me, I'd be able to see the ocean. And I'll tip it back up so I can see. And it is stormy.
My name is Eli Sadler. I'm with oceanhealth.org. I feel like I had a really great turnout. I've been site captain here for, I think, 6 or 7 years now. And pretty comparable, despite the weather. It's really wonderful to see how many people were brave enough to come out here and help out, even though the weather is less than ideal.
Yeah, my name is Doug French. I'm an intern over at the National Park Service. I think it's too bad that the weather was as is. It's been rainy pretty much the entire time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I stepped in like this huge puddle. I was like, great.
My name is Taylor Hill. I live in Vallejo. I work for the Department of Public Works. My grandma lives like 2 blocks away, so I was like, Grandma, can I get some socks? Yeah.
There was talk about seeing maybe some debris from Japan from the tsunami. Did you see much or any of that?
I personally haven't seen any. One of the hard things about especially plastic debris is that it's drifting around the whole ocean over and over again. And so you might see something that might have Japanese writing on it, but it could have come from somewhere entirely different, actually, because the ocean currents just carry things all over the place.
There's trash around the beach, as could be said around most any beach. With the cleanups we've been doing lately, a lot of the volunteers have noticed how there's been less trash than normal, which I think is cool. There's obviously still trash.
I find a lot of garbage, you know, along the Great Highway here, which it seems might get out there, or maybe people would clean up better if they knew that there were bins that were available. Do you think the city could do more about this?
It's hard to say about whether more bins helps or not. It's true that they get full very quick out here at Ocean Beach, and we definitely send people actually along the pathway here to pick up stuff because it is going to eventually end up in the ocean if we don't catch it beforehand. I think that we need to do more about having, clean up all over the city, really.
It's pretty bad. Yeah, I helped a group clean up the Tenderloin, and it took forever. It was terrible.
What do you think could be done to change people's attitudes about littering in the city?
Even just having trash cans around at available locations would be nice. You know, if, I would assume people would think to pack out what they pack in. But if there's even a trash can around, maybe even a recycling and a regular trash can, they might have the opportunity to be more conscious of the fact that there is trash. And even if they want to be good people and pick up other people's trash, I'm not saying they need to bring a bag every time they go to the beach, but if there's something on their way in or out from the beach, couldn't hurt to just toss it in the can right there.
At this point in the day, at the end of the scheduled beach cleanup, the beach is clean. I don't see any garbage on Ocean Beach anywhere. So the people who came out here earlier today and braved the incredible weather that we had, they did a good job.
That's KALW's Ben Trefney reporting from San Francisco's Ocean Beach. The California Coastal Cleanup Day drew more than 50,000 volunteers to 850 sites around the state. They picked up more than 500,000 pounds of trash and recycling. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The reality of trash on California's coastline doesn't deter people from dreaming of living near the ocean. The cleanup happened at Ocean Beach, right on the edge of San Francisco's biggest neighborhood, the Sunset. The neighborhood is so large, it's split into two, an inner and an outer. KALW's Jasmine Lopez brings us another neighborhood postcard. This time, we'll take a peek into the Sunset.
Hello, this is Casey Farrell, and we're at 9th and Irving in San Francisco. Across the street from me now is Art's Hamburgers, or whatever they call themselves now, which In 1967, the waitress had put a little sign in the window with flowers, and it said, "Love Burgers, 25 cents each." And the area really looks like 1965. When the streetcar comes up from a distance in the morning, and there's a slight fog on the wires, you actually see this what looks like electricity or a lightning or, sparks, whatever you want to call it. And that's something, it's not a sound, but you can sure see it.
Hello, my name is Joshua Jordan. I live in the Sunset District of San Francisco, California, on 45th Avenue between Ortega and Pacheco. It's very spread out. It's, for San Francisco, it's pretty quiet. I'd say it's one of the quietest neighborhoods in the city. When the wind is really quiet, you can actually hear the waves crash on the beach, and you hear like this white noise of breaking water on the ocean.
That look into the sunset was brought to us by KALW's Jasmine Lopez. What sounds and stories make your neighborhood unique? You can tell us at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message and we'll try to send a reporter out to your neighborhood. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. Sunshine may be rare on the coast here, but it's plentiful inland. So much so that a bird's eye view of California shows a patchwork of black and shiny rooftops fitted with solar panels. It didn't always look like this. Back in the year 2000, there were fewer than 500 solar rooftops. But by 2012, there were more than 160,000. Much of that growth has happened in just the past few years. And it's accelerating with California leading the charge. So what's happening here? Part of it is that solar's gotten a lot cheaper, and companies are finding creative ways to help people pay for it.
Not everyone is a bank.
Dan Rosen is the co-founder and CEO of Mosaic, one of several companies using crowdfunding to jumpstart renewable energy projects. He says it's like Kickstarter for your electricity bill. You don't need to have tens of thousands of dollars to install solar panels. You just need other people helping you, and they need to know what's in it for them. KALW's Laura Flynn has more.
Ten ballet dancers are following the instructor's lead, swaying and pirouetting across the upstairs studio of the Shaw Anderson Dance Center in Berkeley. As piano melodies spill out the door and dancers walk in and out, managing director Rebecca Johnson explains how and why her studio went solar. For one thing, she says, they were spending too much on utilities, about $400 a month, and then they started noticing their neighbors.
All our neighbors are totally residential homes. And when they got solar, we thought, wow, our roof is the same exact slope. We should be able to get solar as well.
She and her colleagues thought installing solar could help cut those costs. Then, as they were figuring out their options and getting quotes, they got an unexpected offer. A man named Andreas Corrales offered them a lease-to-own system that would supply all of their electricity. They wouldn't owe any money up front, and their monthly bill would drop. When she saw the offer, Johnson says she thought,
it looks too good to be true.
It wasn't. And the dance center signed the lease with Corrales' nonprofit, Revolve.
And our mission is to empower people to invest collectively in renewable energy.
Invest collectively. In other words, to crowdfund the dance center's solar panels. Crowdfunding is exactly what it sounds like. It's a way to raise money from a lot of small donations instead of, say, one giant bank loan. The Dance Center is a classic example. First, Revolve launched a campaign through Indiegogo. In the campaign video, Corrales encouraged people to think about energy as a shared good.
So think about individuals and community centers that are generating their own power on their homes and places of work, that use that energy and then share it with their neighbors.
They raised about $25,000 through foundations and donations from 300 people around the world. That money covered all of the dance center's upfront costs. Then, once the project was underway, they started paying about $300 a month to lease the panels. That money went into a fund that generates interest and helps pay for future projects. So, someone who donated $50 to the dance center's roof wasn't just supporting them, she was also helping other projects down the line.
Our hope is that people will be eager to kind of put their money into something where it does earn a return, but they're not asking for the return back themselves. They're asking for the return to be reinvested into more and more solar, allowing it to grow exponentially.
This is pretty different from how solar providers usually work. In a typical lease, the dance center would make payments to a solar company for 10 or 20 years, then either renew the lease or buy the system at market value. If they didn't or couldn't, the company might take the panels back. With Revolve's model, the dance center will own its system outright after 20 years. Already, their monthly bill has dropped by more than $100. And Johnson says the project's about more than that.
For us, really, as I said, it's not so much the finances as it is the decision that we made, and having our community know that their dancing is now solar powered is just a powerful sense of community.
Revolve is just one of several companies trying out models for crowdfunding solar energy. Dan Rosen is the CEO of Mosaic, an investment crowdfunding company. Their model also offers a return, but this one is for the investors.
Our base of investors can become advocates, are some of the best advocates for clean energy because they're invested in it, because they have skin in the game.
Mosaic provides an online platform where anyone can invest directly in a clean energy project. Investments can be as little as $25.
You know, Warren Buffett is investing a tremendous amount of money in solar right now. But someone asked, do you know who has more money than Warren Buffett? We all do.
So far, Rosen says Mosaic has raised about $3 million to finance 15 different projects. For example, 138 people paid to put solar panels on the roof of the Asian Resource Center, or ARC, a building that houses nonprofits and businesses in Oakland. ARC now makes monthly lease payments of about $340 to Mosaic. That money is used to pay each of those investors a return. Rosen says it can be up to 6%.
I think that that has the appeal for some investors who couldn't otherwise get into investing in solar PV very easily, of being able to make small investments and still get into this market.
Severin Bornstein is a UC Berkeley economist and expert on electricity markets. He says the crowdfunding model makes solar more accessible, but it's still a niche market.
As far as the growth of this industry, I think it's going to be driven very much by the economics, both the true cost of installing solar relative to retail electricity prices and the tax treatment.
Bornstein says right now in California, the retail cost of electricity is higher than the actual cost. That's because most utilities roll the fixed cost of the transmission lines and managing the grid into our electricity bills.
Those very high prices you're paying don't reflect the actual cost of supplying power to you.
Going solar means you produce most of your electricity needs, but you still depend on the grid. So you're no longer paying most of those fixed costs. Instead, the utility absorbs them.
And the utilities recognize that this is giving incentives for people to install solar instead of buy their power from the utility. And as a result, they're trying to change those tariffs.
For example, changing the rates to charge everyone a monthly fee for being connected to the grid, no matter how they get their power. If that happens, Bornstein says the whole solar sector could slow. But for now, it's still growing.
Crowdsourcing and crowdfunding is a way that we can democratize energy.
Rosen from Mosaic sees crowdfunding as a way to change the whole energy industry. He anticipates major growth in solar rooftops, enough to disrupt the way utilities currently work.
Where every home could essentially be a power plant, because it really is inevitable. I mean, if it's cheaper to put solar on your home than not, it'll happen. That's economics.
Solar still makes up less than 1% of the country's total electricity production today. Rooftop solar makes up even less of that. crowdfunding projects have a long road ahead, but they're hoping it's a sunny one. For Cross Currents, I'm Laura Flynn.
That report was supported by a 2013 New America Media Energy Reporting Fellowship in collaboration with Sound Vision Productions' Burn and Energy Journal. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krugbaum, Resu Sussman, Isabel Angel, Leela Day, Julie Kane, Jasmine Lopez, Charlotte Silver, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported, non-commercial public radio.
Let's go to the city.
The voice you're hearing belongs to Maya Dorn, who friends describe as having a voice like a great big sail, a wind inside carrying you away to beautiful unknown places. Maya Dorn is joined by a singer known as E.O. on Friday at the Subterranean Art House in Berkeley. Music starts at 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. No, oh, when the music starts.